Sorry about that, Jackson. Okay. All right. Jackson Hall is having a baby right now, where his wife is having a baby, so he wants me to record the lecture. So we'll talk about process modeling, and particularly about two problems that I call the abstract levels of abstraction challenges in process modeling, which are really important things to understand. We'll talk about blueprinting as one sort of endpoint on this continuum about process modeling, from modeling experience-intensive kind of service systems to those which are more information-intensive, which we'll focus more on Wednesday. And then we'll talk about lean production and consumption as a kind of toolkit you want to have in your head as you look at process modeling to think about, is every time you have an interaction adding value from the customer's perspective? It's a really important way to think about the design of a service system. So let me begin with a kind of one of these MBA moments where I'm giving you all the buzzwords in one slide. Process modelers talk about it in the following way. They say, we do an as-is analysis. That means you go into some situation and you see how it's being done today. You, of course, identify requirements for a number of methods like we've seen so far through literature analysis, competitive analysis, technology review, and so on, observation. And those requirements need to get realized, perhaps, by changing or re-engineering the activities or processes or transactions that you see in the as-is model. You would look for reference models or standard ways or best practices ways of doing things, and you try to use those as you refine the as-is model. And that's how you're going to satisfy the requirements by changing or optimizing the processes, and that's what process design is. When you take the as-is model and you transform it with some new constructs or new sequences or new decision points to have a better model. So when you do as-is modeling, you're looking for four things. And again, these are the traditional words of process models. We're looking for gaps. Those are things that you should be doing, but you aren't. So they're missing activities. There are inefficiencies, which are things that you should be doing, but you're doing them in an inefficient way. And there's, again, I used the phrase a couple weeks ago. I want to see if you remember. Inefficiencies arise sometimes because you have added technology to a process without really thinking about what the process's goals were. You just sort of mindlessly throw technology at it and you automate it, but maybe you're automating things as is rather than as they might be. And we call that something really... the cows? Remember the cows? What do we call this? Paving the cow paths, where you had a traditional way of doing something. The cows have gone to market for 1,000 years this way, so we paved that path rather than saying there might be a better way to put a road in. Overlaps we might detect when we're doing things that we should be doing, but we may be doing them in more than one way. So we have this redundancy where we clearly are wasting resources or effort. And finally, we have opportunities, which are things we might want to do, but we're not doing. So those four things are kind of the standard categorization of your analysis of an as-is model. Things we're doing, but we're not. Things we should be doing, but we're not. Things we're doing, but we're doing inefficiently. Things we're doing more than one way, and things that we should be doing, but we're not currently doing. But what exactly is a process? This is one of those words which is very highly overloaded. And I'd like to think of process models as, sets of processes, right? Arranged in a particular way, either hierarchical or sequentially, or both. And the number of ways in which you present a process model may depend on the number of stakeholders you need to understand. There may be a privileged stakeholder view in a process model, or there may be one which is kind of agnostic, trying to present all stakeholders' views equally. We have diagrams to try to show these process models. As with requirements, while we need to have a use case meta model, it had a lot of structure around scenario diagram and so on. We typically have that with process models because the pictures or the text alone are not sufficient. There's usually a notion of inputs or outputs in a process for an activity. And that often is related to the information flows that are implied in your model, or interactions that are implied in your model. That's somebody is causing something to happen, and someone is the recipient of some action or information. And again, we may have a text description which conforms to some meta model or conventional template. So you'll see pictures like this. It says there's a process which consists of some activity with inputs and outputs. There may be an actor that performs the process, and there may be constraints that have to be satisfied. They can be just about anything. Process models, because of these pretty abstract words, input, output, constraint, actor, because process models can be essentially about anything, and any of those things can be instantiated in many different ways. As you think about your process models, we could say that you have some flow of work in your service system, or flow of information, or flow of control, or transitions between activities taking place over time. Those are four related but distinct ways of thinking about a process model, and of course, that should make it clear why there are a lot of different ways to draw them, or to, represent them, because each of those will highlight some slightly different part of your service system. Are you focusing on information flows, on interactions, or transition between states, or whatever? And we'll see some of those different types of process models today. Process models typically have more than one process, of course, and so you can combine processes according to one of these dimensions of flow of control, flow of transfer of control or something, flow of work, as long as the processes are described in a way where the inputs and outputs are compatible. That sounds pretty obvious. You have to have building blocks that can be building blocks, but that is a very, very difficult thing to do, because it's not always the case that when you have a process description of some process by itself, and you have another process you think you want to combine with it somehow, that they're going to be compatible. And this is where this fundamental challenge that I call levels of abstraction challenge come into play, because you may need different ways of describing a process for different purposes, but if you want to have processes that come together in a process model, you've got to have them be at an equivalent or consistent level of abstraction. So those are two distinct kinds of problems. You may have different levels of description, but you have to have consistent and compatible level of description to make a model out of it. Now, those are so important, I'm going to do some kind of dumb exercise to make sure this is clear, because this is fundamental. This is why most process modeling doesn't work very well, because of one or both of these problems. So, what are we doing now? We could be saying, I'm at Berkeley studying for an advanced degree. Or I could say, I'm taking information systems and service design. Or I could say, I'm in Bob's class on Monday, November 2nd, listening to a lecture about process models and levels of abstraction. They're all correct. Okay? What determines how we answer that question? And that's the key thing. How do we know which level of abstraction to be at? And now I'm not being rhetorical. Now I want you to tell me how you know how to answer that question. When I say, what are you doing now, Jessica? You go, what caused you to say something?
Why?
How do you know how to answer that question?
Right.
Well, that's the point.
So I would ask
you have to say, why? Why do you want to know? Is that what you're asking? Why do I want to know what I'm doing now? That's more hostile than I would have expected.
Well, I would infer what you're trying to figure out and give you an answer that's appropriate to the context.
Appropriate to the context. That's pushing it into the problem of what is context in this situation? We're using that word in a conventional way.
Well, since I'm in the class with you, maybe I wouldn't say I'm in a class with you, since you know that.
Right.
You're honest with me, so.
But think of that. You would answer the question differently than Minnie would, because Minnie's in the class for the first time. So this is her first time in here. So she said, I'm visiting a class at Berkeley. Right? Because again, there's sort of a, what are our expectations? What are our shared knowledge? What do we know about the other person's intents and goals and all that kind of stuff?
That's hard to specify.
How much knowledge do we have in common? How much do we know about each other's context? Yes.
Also looking at questions. So if you ask a question before and tell us on the first day what
All right. If I'd given you expectations about how I want that question, what level of scripture I think is appropriate for this situation, yeah, that would help. So again, it's generally speaking, the more you can assume about the context I think you're in, that we agree on, you can be a more precise answer. But if I haven't talked to you in 3 years and say, what are you doing now? You'll say, oh, I'm now at Berkeley. That's a perfectly reasonable answer. Okay. So that kind of ambiguity about how to describe what you're doing now is exactly the problem of which level of abstraction to attack in a process model. Yeah.
And,
right, you have to know what they know already. Okay, so that's the first problem, but what's the appropriate level of description and abstraction to describe a process? Okay? Or an activity. Here's the second one. Here is, I wrote this, you know, I want to learn to cook, so I wrote a recipe for making pizza, and I wrote it down here. What do you think of my pizza recipe? Does it work? I can make a pizza with this. This is what I did. I wrote this down, that's how I make a pizza. Is it a good process, Mark? Well, what do you mean? I mean, this is what I did. So you think some things are missing? I mean, making a pizza is a description of a process. Right, Joan? Well, it says everything you need. The required ingredients, they're specified. Okay, so there's some problems with this thing. Maybe it's not completely clear, but other than that...
You're not consistent in your level of granularity.
I think that's the biggest problem. I'm looking at things at a very abstract course level, and other times I'm looking at a very precise level. So in fact, the model I really have is this one, okay, where I have the process description of making pizza, which consists of sub-processes of making the dough, making the sauce, adding the sauce and topping to the dough, and then baking it. And each of those has sub-processes, and so on. So I can have a complete process model by having multiple levels of detail. Okay, now, it's easy to see when we're making pizza, because it's a very concrete kind of activity with physical kind of inputs and outputs. Okay? But when we're describing things other than sort of physical objects or concrete documents in the world that they're moving around, which by their very nature are tangible, when we have more intangible activities like education, right, purchasing, you can describe things at a level where you don't see those inputs and outputs very well. So you have a choice of how you describe processes, and one level of description might be at a kind of organizational or business model level. When I say, what is the pattern of value exchanges, or how is value created? What's the value chain? You know, what actors are interacting to achieve some goal or solve some problem? So I can describe things at a level that says, I'm trying to increase the return on capital in my company. I'm trying to increase my competitive position. I'm trying to increase market share. I mean, those are high-level processes that might be perfectly reasonable at a business model or business strategy level. We don't dwell on all the exception cases and all the steps needed to have those done. They don't have business significance. I don't say, first I got to drive my car to the office and then go inside and make some phone calls. All right. I describe it at a very abstract or kind of coarse level of the description. And these are often called level one or qualitative models. high, level one, meaning they're at the top. You can also think at the bottom, but they're typically called level one models because they're the most abstract models. We have another way of level description, which is often called the level two level, where we have steps and activities at a level of detail where we can explain the as-is situation and also see some of the possible places where with those gaps and overlaps and opportunities that in a potential level two, a potential to be model. And this is a level where you see interaction, where you say, ah, I see that company A sends a request to company B. Company B sends back an acknowledgement. Company A publishes a catalog. Company B makes orders from it. This level, we're seeing things that implement the business models at a more operational level, but more at an intentional level that says, we want to run an efficient supply chain as part of our ability, part of our goal to dominate our business markets, our segment. We want to be the dominant consumer packaged goods companies, and we have to run an efficient supply chain. So the goal is dominate the retail packaged goods industry. And the second level model would say, here's what our activities look in our efficient supply chain. This level, though, should be technology independent. We're saying we want to have a good supply chain. We want to have good relationships that are efficient with our customers, be able to send acknowledgments to orders within 24 hours and so on. But we're still not talking about technology. So that means we have a level three model, which is where you talk about the details needed to actually implement the level two model. This is where you'll have relatively little abstraction. You'll have technology dependency. You'll explain how you're going to actually do it. And you'll have all the logic and all the cases and the success and the failure logic that are needed to actually operationalize that activity. Now, these are clearly the views of different levels of the organization. You know, which job category is or level in an organization cares about level one models? What kind of people? People like the CEO and the COO and the, you know, people who are running the company. This is strategic level of the description in the company. Who cares about level two models? These are the level where you're saying, this is the work that has to get done. I want to make sure we have a running efficient supply chain, that we reconcile orders and invoices efficiently. You know, this is operational management. So it's like, this is the management level of a company. Who cares about, you know, the nitty-gritty details of what you do in every single situation? The programmers, that the program, the code of it's going to be automated or something, or the workers, or the people who train the workers. People actually do the activities. So we have the potential for an abstraction gap. So again, this is sort of an MBA moment of sorts, because this is one of those key phrases in your business education here. If we go it just happens to be in my search window. Bridging the gap between business and IT will bring up a gazillion papers and books, because that's the key challenge for companies. How to bridge this abstraction gap between the level of description that says, we're trying to be, you know, the dominant player in this business sector. We want to take over the consumer packaged goods industry. We want to be the innovative company in consumer electronics. And when we take an order, you have to update the records in the SAP system and blah, blah, blah. There's a very big gap there between the level one model and the level three model. And it may be uncrossable, right? Because the level one model is the one that executive management has. It's a top-down view of the business. Level three is the one that you naturally get when you look at people or talk to them or observe them, right? That's the one that is being worked, okay? That's the one that people are actually doing. And the one in the middle may be missing. Because it's the one that's the hardest to create. Okay? It's easy to have an executive say, here's our strategic vision of this class. Strategic goals are these. And it's easy to talk to people who are doing the work saying, well, what are you actually doing? They go, well, first I get this form, and I do this, and I turn to this, and I send it to them, and I call this, and I run this application. The middle level of the scripture which says, what are the a level that is more managerial? It's harder to get in a consistent way that has the kind of right amount of space between the level 1 and the level 3 model to meet, to bridge that gap. If it's too abstract, it's practically like a level 1.5 model. It doesn't have enough insight about the actual day-to-day technological operation. And if it's a level 2.5 model, it's a barely disguised, you know, it's pseudocode as opposed to code. Okay? So finding that level 2 sweet spot is actually pretty hard. Okay? And so this idea of bridging the gap is, you know, you saw all the hints when I did the search, that's the thing that the successful company will find a way to bridge that gap. Now the problem is that the consensus is we need something in the middle there between level 1 and level 3, but what exactly is it is not nearly as much consensus. So most of the challenge in process modeling is to find something which is a level 2 model, which is actually a level 2 model as opposed to a 1.5 or a 2.5. And that's really hard to explain in practice. You sort of recognize it when you see it. I got it described it the way that actually works for both the executives and the workers. But that's the kind of real challenge of process modeling, finding that level 2 model. This is not a new problem for us. We've seen this before when we talked about this picture. Remember? A long time ago we talked about component business models and we talked about organizational architecture and the influence on the relationship of this and technology and so on. Here you see a description of a firm at 3 levels. Activities described at the directing level, the executive strategy level. We do planning, we do account planning, we do sales planning, we do fulfillment planning and so on. At the level 3 level, the execution level, you know, we hire people, we run market campaigns, we sell stuff, we talk to customers, we route sales orders. In the middle, it's like, well, we do relationship management. All right? It's in the middle, clearly, but, you know, the devil's in the details here. Which is why people like IBM are trying very hard to sort of flesh this picture out with their best practice. They think their secret sauce is being able to write down what's in those middle boxes. That's the hardest part of this model to get right, what's in the middle layer of those boxes. So we'll see this three-level thing a lot on Wednesday because I mentioned that there are these the idea of a reference model as a way to sort of codify through best practices or through some kind of standards to describe how some particular business domain works. You'll see things like RosettaNet or SCORE or other kinds of business and technology standards often have the three-level thing because that seems to be a good way to describe stuff. Somehow it's like, here's the level where information buzzes around in the technology. Here's the level of we're trying to run a supply chain or be a low-cost producer. In the middle is where the real hard stuff is. So we'll see that level 2 stuff in the context of a level 1 to 3 on Wednesday. Now, some of you have done some of this. I know that Aaron's done some of this, right? I mean, this is, again, I'm trying to abstract characterization of the problem, but you easy to do level 3 models because that's what you're describing what people are doing. I'm using this software, this is the interface, or this other piece of software, and so on. And level 1 is like, well, we're a company that's in, you know, trying to be the low-cost producer of, or high-quality producer of educational software. It's like the middle level. Precisely. The workers stay intact in little groups. The executive suite doesn't really move around. It's that middle level of management. What's the right way to characterize that second tier of this model? That's a good insight that's really the point. That's the part where we can't get it right. We keep trying to get it right, that second level of management. Okay. So let's talk about this sort of process modeling continuum. And we've talked about this or caricatured it several times. We talked about it with ethnography. We'll talk about it many, many times in the rest of the semester with prototyping. For modeling, we have this, again, this continuum about, are we modeling an experience-intensive kind of service system or an information-intensive service system? And the point of view will be different. We'll often be focused on the human actors, the customer, the user, to use words which I'm deliberately using in quotes because we know those are more complicated terms than just those. Or we could have the system as the focal point, or in fact, maybe multiple systems as the focal points. For experiences, we often have emotional kind of qualitative content of the experience. And for systems, we often are focusing on the information exchanges. The information exchanges are the interactions as opposed to other things that happen in a person-to-person encounter. We use words like experience that are a form of drama in which the actors and audience co-create value through their interconnected and reciprocal roles and actions. We don't use the word co-create when we're talking about machines sending messages to each other. Co-creation of value is a buzzword in the service industry. It's getting more buzzwordy every day. I can't make myself think that web services co-create value yet. Maybe I'm just resisting that too hard. But it's clear that kind of idea of we can have collaboration, coordination between computational services. I can't have like this kind of empathic co-creation of value thing going on. Part of that is because in an experiential context, you often have actors who have choices. I can choose to go to the hotel. I can choose to go to the spa. I can choose to go to the restaurant if I'm at a hotel. But somehow, if I'm carrying out a business process which is information intensive and, you know, there's documents moving around or is information moving around between business systems, information doesn't sit there and says, do I want to go to the SAP system today or not? So it doesn't have the same kind of discretionary character, and that also will shape the way you feel about the process. I mean, the idea of a happy case and a sad case, success, you know, I think success, failure, happy, I don't think web services get happy or sad. All right, that kind of difference in the vocabulary is not just accidental. Okay, and so as a result, we have different concepts, and particularly we have different techniques for describing experiential process models than we do for modeling system process models. And again, we'll see more of the system stuff on Wednesday. So I'm going to focus for the rest of the lecture on these experiential process models, in particular this service blueprinting technique, which is really, I would say, in terms of mind share, it has a great deal of mind share in the service design on the experiential end of the service system continuum. So we've used these words. We had a lecture on the service encounter. We use these words, the touch points and moments of truth. Again, those are very powerful words that suggest this kind of person-to-person, emotional, empathic kind of interactions where customers and service providers are interacting to co-create value. There's a number of touch points in every service system where customers interact with a business. Think of how many interactions you have in a hospital or an airline or a hotel or a school, right, where there's all the different people you interact, all the different systems you interact with. And maybe dozens of these touch points. And your goal as a designer of that service system should be to say, which one of those are the essential ones? Which ones of those are the most important in creating the value the customer cares about? Which ones can create some kind of emotional bond that will increase the customer's satisfaction, loyalty, desire to return and spend more money, to increase their proportion of their spending on that particular relationship, and so on. Those are the kind of decisions we're trying to make. And again, the papers on lean design and the design structure matrix are very much focused on this. So while blueprinting says, let's describe the as-is model, the set of touch points and so on, the lean consumption and the DSM papers are really much focused on concepts for identifying and exploiting those touch points which are the ones that really add value. Or to put it another way, driving them out, driving any touch point out that doesn't add value. So we want to analyze our process models, our as-is models, and to identify those places where value is not being created, or worse, where value is being destroyed. I mean, it's important to see that that a touch point can destroy value as well as create value. I don't need to remind you of that. But you go to a customer support interface, human, face-to-face or online. You're talking to someone, you want some relief because of some situation you have. You can leave that encounter worse off than you were when you got there. You're destroying customer value in that service system. And I know that many of you, and you looked at your observations, saw that there were often negative stakeholders involved whose goal was to destroy customer value or to prevent value from being created of a certain kind because it didn't meet their agendas and so on. Okay. Now, as we said when we talked about requirements and use cases, words aren't enough. You need diagrams. Maybe I should say that bad words aren't enough, because it's really easy to write bad process models. As I showed you, you could write models that have an inappropriate level of description or inconsistent level of the detail, where you miss something important by having the wrong level of description. Okay? And that's easy to do when you have the more abstract kind of interactions where, again, it's hard to see exactly how the value is being created. And education is a service system. You know, say education creates value, that's not very useful. You need to get below that to talk about the kinds of touch points in the education system which add value, which ones destroy value. Sometimes exams can destroy value because they have negative consequences for student self-esteem and so on. All right? So just as with requirements, by the way, have your team thought about who's going to be the requirements lead? Because we want to start that assignment this week, and I want someone to be working with HP this week to get Ravenflow going. So you're prepared to do that this afternoon, I think, right? If people need help today to get started on that. All right. So again, just as Ravenflow's goal in... I know, this, you're in the hot seat, Minnie. That's a bad place to sit. It's just that thing's broken. I've been trying to get it to come down, and you know, I pushed the magic button. Well, up works. Down, you see this thrashing? It's going to blow up. It was that way when I got here. Wasn't it? I didn't break it. It was that way when I got here. Don't blame me. That's one of Homer Simpson's rules for success in the business world. Boss, what a good idea, boss. It was that way when I got here. His famous saying is you have to learn to be successful in business. Those are the first two I remember. Good idea, boss, and it was that way when I got here. So again, Ravenflow has the goal of taking your unstructured text and refining it to be able to produce good diagrams. And diagrams are proof that you have a complete and logically consistent and coherent model. And likewise, the purpose behind blueprinting is to use a meta model to describe a business process which has got a very strong customer-facing element to ensure that you focus on getting the model right. So that paper that you read, as I had you read the Bittner paper from the California Management Review, was from a conference that was held here a couple years ago on service design. And I think it's a really wonderful paper that has a really good explanation of both the tool as an abstraction as well as how to go about using it in real work. Again, it says, let's focus on services which sort of where value is created over a set of transactions over time or interactions over time. And I think that it's underexploited because blueprinting is often characterized as a customer and front stage dominant kind of tool, but there's no reason why that customer can't be one of the backstage employees. And so, in fact, I often, I will require you, so I think it's a good idea because I'm going to require it, to do blueprints that essentially consciously invert the process to draw a blueprint which focuses you on the front stage and the things that happen at the encounter, both for the nominal user and for someone who is a backstage participant, because that forces you to see the thing from the other point of view, and you may see things in the middle, which otherwise would be hidden behind the lines of visibility from one side or the other. So you might remember in the 7 context paper I show from last year's class, blueprints for both the customer of the bookstore and the customer and the employee of the bookstore, and I'll show those in a few minutes. All right, the one of the big ideas of blueprints is that it's a way to visualize the process. Again, it's focusing on two things: the actual points where customer value is created or revealed in that service encounter, and something that they call the tangible evidence, which is really big in the sort of physical, tangible sort of, in the person-to-person service design literature, being that how do you, because the customer know that the service has been delivered? Because services are often intangible, what evidence do you leave the customer with to give them some confidence that the service is either about to be delivered or has been delivered in a high-quality way? So best look at that by example. If you look at the overnight hotel stay example from the Bittner paper, you'll see the key line is called the line of interaction. That's the one here in the middle where you have the customer and what's called the onstage or contact employee. This shows the interactions, the touch points, the service encounter touch points unfolding over time. You can imagine this being a timeline. We could put actual time on it, day, hour, whatever it is. You could describe an observation this way. This could be a way to describe an ethnography, perhaps, an abstraction of what took place in your observations. This moment in time, this happened, this happened, this happened, this happened, kind of thing. You also see what's called the line of visibility, which we've talked about before in front stage, backstage design, that from the perspective of the customer, there's a set of a line beyond which they can't see services taking place, which may in fact be essential in creating the value that will be revealed at the touch points. And there may be, in fact, be another line, which we'll call the line of internal interaction, which is the backstage relative to the frontline employee. There may be things going on in the system which the frontline employee depends on, but which cannot see. These may be things which are done by third-party providers. When I'm the hotel front desk employee, I can see my business system, but I can't see Expedia. I can see there's a reservation taken, but I can't see Expedia. I can see what Expedia sent me, but not I can't see Expedia's business system. I can see the airline record, but I can't see the airline reservation system. That kind of thing. The difference there could be crucial. And again, we could flip this chart around and see from the front desk employee treating them as the customer and so on. So this idea of the blueprint is that there's a meta model, as you see, these 5 kinds of descriptions: the physical evidence, the customer actions, the online or front stage employee action, the backstage or contact employee action, or support processes. These could just be services. So in the Bittner paper, these are called actions, and by employees or by people, they could be actions or activities done by computational agents as well. I think that's very useful to do that. Even though Bittner says we could use this technique to model these kind of computational actors, I think that it implicitly deprecates a lot of the computational actors because they're often hidden in the backstage when you're focusing on the canonical customer user. And so this idea of doing both blueprints is a way to help get some visibility on these backstage services, and you can maybe see how they could be better designed or reused by doing that. Okay, there's this notion again of tangible evidence. Oh, sorry, I'm out of order. There it is. Okay. So, the methodology of blueprinting, again, should be pretty straightforward at this point. Identify the customer types, again, which could be done by lots of different ways. You could have personas you're modeling for. You could have a blueprint for each persona. We could have a blueprint for each customer segment you identify through more traditional market research means. For each customer, you say, what does the customer do at each of those touch points? For each of those touch points, which of the employees or services of the service provider are going to be carrying out that interaction? providing information, providing the co-created value. And then you want to link that touch point to the backstage services or activities that are needed to do that. Now, they have this, you see, parenthetically, they say, well, gee, you could have a technology front stage if it's a self-service touch point. Again, that's, as I said, it is extensible in that way, but I think that implicitly is saying that, oh yeah, if you have one of those kind of weird cases where you don't have people, then you can use a technology actor rather than a human actor. And I think that's why it's important to make it a first-class citizen by focusing on that and other kinds of models. And finally, you add physical evidence, which are these the tangible things that help you realize that something happened. We'll talk about that in just a second. Okay. Again, this I think I've already said most of these things. Yeah, I have. Okay. All right. So again, this idea of the tangible evidence, service designers of the person-to-person variety are really big on this idea that there should be things you build in the environment, in the, I hate to use this word, but it's big, service-scape, like the landscape, the service-scape. Any of you heard that word? I hate that word. Right? The service-scape, you design the service-scape in which the service encounter takes place. That may be things as physical as the color of the walls, the nature of the carpet, the business cards that the person hands you, the uniform that they're wearing. Because those things are really important. If you think back to the service quality model, those things shape expectations. If I walk up to a store and the store is dirty and the employees are dressed in raggedy clothes that look like they're one of the customers, I have a different experience than I walk in there and the store is impeccable and everyone's wearing a kind of a store uniform of some kind. You walk up to a restaurant and there's a guy at the front desk in a fancy uniform, very different than if there's, you know, seat yourself. So this kind of tangible evidence is important. And again, that's why often where that's hard to produce because the service is more intangible than others. I mean, in a restaurant, you get the food. You get the smell of the food. You get the taste of the wine. Okay? In school, you don't have that kind of same tangibility of the experience. So we give you a diploma instead. Okay? Or a transcript, which is your tangible evidence that you got something out of that experience. Because you won't have the same kind of physical evidence as you might in a more service-scapey kind of service encounter. Bittner makes the point of recommending the as-is and the to-be blueprints, and makes a very nice idea that says you want a blueprint, you can competition. Go see, try to describe how they do things. Then you could, if you have the same level of abstraction, you can line up yours to theirs and easily see some kind of things. What would those things you might be able to see if you compared your blueprint with their blueprint? Where is it? Things like gaps, inefficiencies. You compare yours with theirs and you say, we don't have one of those. Does that add value or is that one of our competitive advantages that we don't have one of those? So you compare ours with theirs. I mean, think about, maybe remember the another kind of a business model description, the value chain description of the generic restaurant or the generic hotel. We showed generic hotel has reservations, check-in, you know, sleeping, eating, checking out. The budget hotel has very little, and the Ritz-Carlton has lots of them. Remember the number of touch points? At a finer level of granularity, you could have a blueprint that shows exactly what's going on in each of those interactions. And say, gee, our hotel doesn't have someone take the bags to the room for the customer. Maybe that's not good. Now, if it's a budget hotel, then no one expects it. So it would be, you'd think a little weird if someone said, let me take your bags to the room, sir. And you're going, Motel 6? It wouldn't make sense. You wouldn't expect that, right? But if it's a fancy hotel, you're going, where's the guy taking my bags to the room? What's up with that? You notice that it was not there, and then we would suffer as a result. So, this idea of doing a blueprint of your competition, I think, is a quite good one. Okay, MJ makes a big point about how blueprints have the property of giving the entire organization a view of the service system scope. And we talked a bit about scoping and how maybe different people may have different views of what the scope is. That's really important to get on the same page there. So let me think of an example in terms of the restaurant. Okay, so in the restaurant, again, if you are blueprinting a restaurant, in the normal sense, you may say, well, the restaurant experience starts when the person makes the reservation and then shows up to the restaurant to eat and then has the dinner and then goes home, right? But if you're trying to manage a locavore experience where the person is going to have some satisfaction out of having eaten locally grown food, then you've got to manage previous touch points where the food is picked up, where the farmer negotiates with the restaurant, where you know the food is delivered in a way which is not contaminated and so on and so on. So the blueprint would have to be wider in the locavore restaurant than it is in the regular restaurant. And that might be a case where people don't realize that that's an essential part of the value creation for that customer class. So you'd have having that blueprint would help demonstrate that to all your employees, that we care about the other stuff, not just what happens in the restaurant. Okay, so this is, I'm not going to go through this. This is the blueprint from the Bookland customer. Remember that's the case where the customer wants to go in because it's a smart bookstore, the customer can go up to the kiosk and be suggested books that they saw online, even though they've never been in the physical store before and so on. The opposite of the employee's blueprint, where it's focused on value creation for the employee. So when the employee has a touch point because it says, this book is left in the coffee shop, it's now a zombie book from the perspective of the bookstore, that's great because that means that that's a very information-rich experience, interaction for the employee. They don't have to wander around to find books that are in the wrong place. They have a very clear transaction where that information is conveyed instead of it being a goose chase in the bookstore. A more conventional one is this one. This is the express mail service. Again, you see the customer essentially talking to the drivers of the packages picked up here, right? So the customer goes online and orders the book pickup through an invisible system. They just see the interface to it. The driver comes, they see the driver, the guy in the brown suit comes and picks up the package and says, hi, Letty. Picks up the package and puts it on the truck. All this then invisible stuff happens where the package actually gets delivered. This is the airplanes and the airports and the trucks and all that, and then finally the package comes back and there's another face-to-face front stage encounter. But this is quite clear here that the value is being created by all sorts of backstage activities, and it's being revealed when the package arrives at the appointed time. No amount of love and empathy and empowerment and all those kind of good person-to-person words at that encounter will make up for the fact if the plane didn't get there on time or if the package was dropped on the floor at the UPS sorting facility in Nashville and didn't make it to the plane in the first place. So again, this really helps see where the points of value creation are and how many of them would be obvious to the customer. So again, when we talk about things like the service quality model, the gap model, remember that the customer's expectations are likely to be shaped by these, and they won't have any notion about these. They just sort of, it just happens, right? It's magic. And yet, that may be the critical parts of your service system able to create and preserve value. All right. You all did read this paper, right? So I can ask you about my favorite part of it, which is the Lake Powell houseboat. Let's talk about that case study. What happened in the Lake Powell blueprint story? What was the key problem they were trying to address? Marianne.
They forgot to research the picture and videos to figure out, oh, people think it's cumbersome to have to go grocery shopping and put in this little kitchen on the houseboat and let's offer chefs.
Yeah, I mean, have any of you ever done one of these things? I once thought about going on a houseboat in Lake Mead, or Lake Powell, whatever it was, and I looked at the brochure and said, this is too much work. I really thought this is too much work, because they expect you to show up in Las Vegas and go to the dock and then bring all your food to the place and have to, you know, basically load it onto the boat and, you know, all this stuff. And they wondered why they were not attracting the high-end business clientele that they had priced the service for. And they compared, who they compared this blueprint with? They compared it with the high-end hotel experience. So you're saying, if you're going to pay $500 a day, do you want to schlep your groceries? Or do you want to walk under the boat and have them already put away in the refrigerator or in the pantry? That kind of thing. And of course, when you walk into the Ritz-Carlton, you don't schlep your bag to your room. You know, you walk into the front desk and they go, oh, we'll take those. And they make a point. The really good hotels, they had this kind of clever distraction. Well, maybe you've never had the fortune of experiencing this, but often the high-end hotels, you get there, they go, oh, welcome back, Mr. Gluster. Nice to see you again. Would you like a glass of champagne? A welcoming champagne. Oh, I'd love to. Sit down with your spouse or your girlfriend, whoever you're with there in the lobby, and you have a glass of champagne, and you say, this is a great hotel. This is wonderful. You get up and you go to your room, and your bags are there. Because they did the champagne to kill the 5 minutes so they could get you back to the room. Because that way you go, isn't this hotel great? The service is perfect. The bags are already here. Right? But they deliberately introduced this other touch point with the champagne to buy the 5 minutes. Okay? So it's very conscious management of that interaction. Okay? Or they'll say, oh, have you seen our new pool? Let me show you. We renovated the pool. Let me show you the new pool. And they walk out to the patio and say, look at this. We have this new pool here. You know, we'd like us to make reservations for you at the tennis courts. And they're doing, but they're buying you the 5 minutes to get your bags to the room. Because someone did a very careful time study, said, we need at least this much time to get the bags to the room. And so let's, what can we do to make that 5 minute wait? Instead of saying, go to the room, where the hell are my bags? All right? So they've taken the waiting time and made it into an encounter. Okay? It's basically like a magic with sort of a sleight of hand, a diversion. But the result is that you get a higher end service experience, because they've taken what would have been, you know, a time you would have viewed as not value creating, namely the wait time, and made it into a value creation time of having the glass of champagne in the lobby or wandering around looking at the new pool or the new spa or whatever it is. So yeah, it's a very nice case study for that. And it nicely goes us to this last topic about lean consumption. So this is a topic that some of you have studied, this kind of like Toyota production and Six Sigma and just-in-time manufacturing. All right, some of you have done. I know we've talked about it in the past. This is one of the key concept that comes out of that body of work. The book by Womack, Jones, and Roos called The Machine That Changed the World. And the trick in that title is that the machine is the production machine, meaning the methods of doing production in the Toyota factories. Not the machines in the factory, but it's the method is the machine. All right, they call the production system the machine. And this basically says, how do we integrate the principles, practices, tools, and techniques to reduce waste, synchronize workflow, and manage variability? And that's the key goals in a lean manufacturing. Have no waste, have no people waiting around because inventory is not ready for you or things like that. And manage the fact that demand will be variable. So you can't have people saying, do a batch at a time, because you may not have a batch at a time. If you have to wait for a batch, you'll be sitting around with nothing to do for a while. So the key focus in this analysis is to say, where are the value-adding activities and where are the non-value-adding activities? And ruthlessly drive all of those out okay, by analyzing an as-is against a to-be kind of vision of the production system. So there's a notion called the value stream map, which is very big in this area. It's basically a blueprint or a process diagram with time on it. It's saying the clock is ticking as we go through these steps. And if you have a customer sitting there with the clock ticking, you say, 5 minutes, I'm sitting there with my bags, I want to change and go to the pool or go play tennis, and I can't because my bags aren't here. So I'm wasting my time. The clock is ticking in a negative way for you at that hotel. Click, click, click. Finally, the bags show up. Tell me where the bag's been. Right? And you're mad at the poor guy bringing the bags in. Versus champagne, and then the bags are already there. So you've taken that time, and now it's value creating. So think about, it's the same philosophy as blueprinting, in that there's this kind of notion of, let's have a process description that gives us a common understanding, but it has a more quantitative approach. So the people who do Six Sigma are measuring all stuff. And they want to basically keep track of those, what's the distribution and variance of our times and so on, so we can drive out the variability which caused it to be less than optimal time. So they're out there defining, measuring, controlling, those kind of verbs, as opposed to describing kinds of words, which you see in the more blueprint qualitative stuff. But the problems that this approach is trying to solve in a production or operational context really have to do with the fact that you have some notion of a service system, or service production system, to use the word they tend to use, where you have a set of steps, each of which is supposedly adding some incremental value. And you would want to standardize those as much as possible to drive out the variation, which is sort of the unplanned stuff. We talked a lot about how to do that with scheduling or making offers, or sort of yield management, all those kind of things that you might impose as demand management discipline to reduce some of the variation. There's always going to be some leftover variation unless you plan for it. And the way you plan for it in a production system of this type is that you say, let's give every service worker responsibility for a complete sort of body of work. Okay? And so the idea is to never let there be fragmented workflow, because there's a lot of handoff between people, or have such big blobs of work where people will be waiting around for the next person to hand them something. So there's kind of, again, an optimal granularity of work description so that you can more readily manage the flow of things through it, the flow of people through it, or the flow of things through it. So think of things like telephone customer support, right? If you have levels of support where if you can't solve the problem yourself, you say, let me find somebody who can solve it, and you get rid of them, because they otherwise would make you have too variable a response. Okay? So again, the key is to manage value from the customer's perspective and say, how do I make sure the customer's getting value at every step in this process, and not focus on your processes from your perspective. And that sounds kind of counterintuitive, that you want to manage their perspective rather than yours, but their point is that this actually makes it easy for you to eliminate the activities which don't actually contribute to your customer value. And so one of the big ideas is this notion of single piece flow, which says that instead of having partial work products where you do the first part, then someone else the next part, and so on, you have one interaction that which the customer and the provider try to solve problems from beginning to end. Think about the difference if you have those kind of experiences where you have one person says, let me try to solve this problem for you, versus, oh, let me refer you to some other department, and it goes back and forth and back and forth. Each time you do a referral, you've got to actually transfer the state, transfer the information, and you tell them the story again, and you basically have these encounters which add no value. So if you have to have a handoff, you make the handoff clean. Again, this is, you can imagine how in the industrial view, it's like, make sure all the parts are of the right tolerance, everything you need to do, the next step is there. This says, give people, if you hand them to another person, give them all the information. So when you call the airline, it says, when I dial United Airlines, if you dial 1-800-9 or whatever, and it says, to make sure we send you to the right person, please enter your frequent flyer number. What they're doing is basically saying, oh, should we give you good service or bad service? Because you're a good customer or a random customer. And they go, you type in your number. To make sure we've got this right, give us your name and number. Give us your name. Osama bin Laden. And go, thank you, Mr. bin Laden. All right? And they said, we'll give this information to the person we're referring you to now. Now we say that, but the person goes, they say, welcome, Mr. Glass. They say, good, that's a good sign. They say, who am I speaking to? You go, you know this already. If you don't, I'm going to be done. Hang up. Right? Because they said, we haven't preserved that value, making you enter the information again. That's really annoying, right? So, the example in the paper had to do with the car repair, and the really nice contrast when the first case, you want to get your car fixed, you call to make an appointment. You call them, and they say, oh, well, what's wrong with your car? And you talk about the phone for a while, but then they, when you get there, they make you do it again. And you see these places where the clock is ticking. So this you see the places where there is value that's not being created, wasted time. And then when they have the new blueprint, essentially, they show that the amount of good time, maybe the green time here, is a lot bigger in proportion because they've eliminated all the activities that don't add value. All right, so let me review what I just did. I'm going to show you the five key slides of today's lecture. Go back over here to the contents page. Okay. Page 6. Actually, page 5. What is a process model? Process model, again, is a description of a set of processes which are connected, maybe have some hierarchical or sequential detail, inputs, outputs, constraints. The key idea, though, is that you have to have solutions with these two levels of abstraction description problem. One is that you have the comparable level of detail of each process that can plug together, and that you have a consistent level of detail within each level. Otherwise, we have this abstraction gap where we have level one model, which is just fine for the executive decision strategic level of the company. Top down, good at describing the business's goals. Then you have this bottom up level three model, which is how you do stuff, how you code the stuff. But they're so far apart that they can't talk to each other. You can't see whether your level three model is actually implementing the level one model, essentially. So we need to have a consistent level of description in the middle, and that's the hard thing to do, bridging the abstraction gap. We talked about service blueprinting, and the key thing there is to understand this meta model, that there's these different parts of the blueprint. Again, these different lines of the interactions between the front stage and the customer, and again between the employee and the backstage with respect to the employee. And having those two different levels of interaction, I think, will be really important in our models, because if you think in terms of, to go way, way back to like Aptian Mason, we talked about how every service can be described in terms of three kinds of interactions: physical interactions, interpersonal interactions, and symbolic informational interactions. If we can isolate some informational interaction, we can push it over here, where it is invisible with respect to the employees, because it could be done in Bangalore as well as Berkeley. It can be transparently substituted because you don't have to know the details of it, because you defined in a way which is purely based on information exchange rather than any need to have personal or physical interactions. And with that, I think we're done with today's lecture. Wednesday, I hate to say it, but the things I'm having you read is my book. There's a section there about the information supply chain that we'll talk about these reference models for these information-intensive business systems. And then chapter 9, we'll be talking more detail about the use of things like sequence diagrams and activity diagrams as representations or notations for doing business process models and choreography where you are treating the actors really as information producers and consumers rather than having this kind of person-to-person dimension. All right, with that...